Good morning. Today we'll have the first hearing of the September 2009 Tournament of Court. Our first case is United States against Neal. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
Good morning. In the case of court, my name is Lieutenant Dylan Ambrose, counsel for the appellant in this case, Airman Raymond Neal. Chief Judge Efron, with your permission, I'd like to request 3 minutes for rebuttal.
You may.
The judge advocate general has certified a number of issues to this court, but it boils down to two real issues, jurisdiction and constitutionality. Because the former is a threshold issue, I will tend to deal with that first, then move on to the constitutional issue. There are several arguments we made in this area, but the first is the government waived its appeal by failing to request delay before the court martial became finalized. Article 62 authorizes governmental interlocutory appeals. RCM 908 puts the meat on the bones. The skeletal Article 62 is flushed out by the RCM 908 and the procedures set forth in there. In RCM 908 D1, it states, after an order or ruling which may be subject to an appeal by the United States, the court martial may not proceed, except as matters unaffected by the ruling, if the trial counsel requests a delay to determine whether to file a notice of appeal under this rule. Conversely, it will proceed absent this request. The rationale for this is set forward in the Manual for Court Martial, Appendix 21, Act 58. It states, it is to provide the trial counsel with a mechanism to ensure that further proceedings do not make an issue moot before the government can file its notice of appeal. Therefore, the burden is on the trial counsel to stand up and request delay if he wants to implement, if he wants to use an Article 62 appeal. Furthermore, RCM 908 also gives the trial counsel no more than 72 hours. Therefore, it's not just 72 hours, it's no more than 72 hours.
Didn't they lodge it within 72 hours?
It didn't take longer than 72 hours, but no more than 72 hours indicates that it could happen within before 72 hours. There could be a limit.
Didn't they lodge it within 72 hours?
Yes, they did, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. Only the next day, after the court martial was final and after the trial counsel had spoken with the members about the case, did the government appeal this case. It was a day later, 24 hours later.
Just to be clear, you're saying they get the 72 hours, but they have to request the delay instantly.
That's correct.
That's the hinge of your jurisdictional argument.
That's correct.
Anything else to it? I'm not disparaging it. I'm just saying that's it, right?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, that's the basis of it. However, there are two other issues regarding the Federal Circuit's application of what happens when a court martial, when a military judge or any type of judge discharges the members. And once that discharge is complete, it's the fait accompli of the court martial or the trial. They cannot resume the trial. The members cannot be brought back in order to do deal with any more business in that court martial.
So is it not the delay for the sake of the delay, but the fact that because of the delay, the court members were discharged? Is that the problem with the failure to request a delay?
Yes, Your Honor. It's certainly attached to that. I can think of a scenario where the court martial, yes, Your Honor, it does deal with that. It's no longer interlocutory at that point because of the fact that this happened after the court martial was finalized. Not only that, whatever decision an appellate tribunal can make is speculative because I don't think any sort of decision by this court or the lower court could have an effect, a legal effect, on that court martial because it can no longer come back together and address any issues.
Didn't the Supreme Court address something like this in U.S. v. Scott, saying you didn't have a constitutional right to the same batch of jurors?
I'm not aware of that case, Your Honor. However, the federal circuits are pretty clear on this when it comes to resumption of trial. It cannot be done once the members have been discharged.
Is that because of double jeopardy or because of some other reason?
I believe it does implicate double jeopardy, yes. I think there are also reasons behind it is the fact that these members, the people who are trying you, who have heard your full case and can make a decision based on this, once they are left to dispersed into the wind, they can no longer keep being that decisional body that decides.
Well, but isn't there a judicial economy argument?
In what respect, sir?
In respect to that, you don't have a right to be tried by the same bunch of people. It may be awkward. You may have to get a different jury. You have to get different members. But that's really a judicial economy argument, isn't it?
No, Your Honor, I think that it goes on the double jeopardy as well. I think the issue is...
Are you arguing 908 or double jeopardy?
Yes, Your Honor, I am arguing that, but I don't think that's necessary.
Wait, choose which one?
Well, you can say both.
I will argue the double jeopardy. The fact that members have been dispersed...
You just told me you were arguing 908. You can argue both.
Our 908 is a different matter. It doesn't require the double jeopardy implications. I think the waiver is enough in itself. And even if we weren't to find a per se rule per the federal circuit court cases that resumption of trial is impossible in this case, I think, as applied to this case, this is a scenario that requires us to...
What should the judge have done then not to eclipse the jurisdiction, as you are arguing?
Excuse me, sir?
What was the alternative then? The government says, we request a delay, and they instantly say, we request a delay. Within 72 hours, they come back and say, we're seeking an interlocutory appeal. At that point, according to your theory of the law, what should the judge have done?
The judge should have allowed the appeal. If he doesn't...
So what's he do with the jurors? He says, please sit there and we'll be back to you in a couple of years?
Essentially, yes. He recesses them and says, you are no longer to discuss this case with anybody else.
You're subject to the recall of the chair from Afghanistan and Iraq or wherever they might
be. That's correct. And then that would be the normal process for an Article 62 appeal.
And that's what the Congress contemplated.
That's what the Congress contemplated. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Counsel, what about Rule 505, which permits the convening authority of the military judge to substitute the convening authority to substitute new members when members have been excused by either the military judge or the convening authority, if in this case the military judge has allowed a situation to take place in which the members are prejudiced because of a discussion with counsel? Can't they be replaced under Rule 505?
Your Honor, I think the federal case law, it would run against the grain of the federal case law.
Are we in a federal district court, or are we in a court-martial governed by the rules of evidence promulgated by the President, or are you suggesting that Rule 505 is an impermissible action by the President under Article 36?
No, Your Honor. I think RCM 405 is a legitimate presidential proclamation fulfilling some of the UCMJ. However, I don't think that's a scenario. That's a scenario that normally exists or would exist when in the midst of trial. And here we have something that's after trial, replacing members after trial had already finished and they've been discharged.
Counsel, doesn't Rule 810 specifically address that in the rules for court-martial when it deals with procedures for rehearing new trials and other trials? And it says that the original members cannot sit again at a retrial or starting over again.
Yes, Your Honor, if it were a retrial, and a retrial may be necessary here.
Well, or a rehearing, it says.
Well, in a rehearing, I don't think a rehearing would be possible because of the federal case law that says resumption of trial is impossible once the member...
What federal case law?
Why is that federal case
law? No, what? What cases?
Camden, they're listed in my brief. Camden is the case that kind of sets forward a Seventh Circuit case that deals with...
And that's decided by who?
That was cited by appellant in his brief. By appellant.
No. Which court decides?
The Seventh Circuit.
Seventh Circuit.
Seventh Circuit gave two theories of resumption of trial. The first one, the majority decided that once the military judge says discharge, once the judge said discharge, that was done. And in Judge Posner actually dissented and said it's not that so much as it's when they actually disperse and they can no longer be reassembled.
Is there any rule similar to Rule 505 in the Article 3 Federal District Court system?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
Is there any rule similar to RCM 1007 or 1009 that allow members to be called back to correct an erroneous announcement of sentence or to clarify a sentence?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Your Honor, there are certainly ways in order to bring the court-martial members back in.
I'm sorry. Just finish your sentence, if you would.
RCM 1102 allows for post-trial sessions before authentication. However, there's nothing that deals specifically with a dismissal of charges, and then the members are discharged.
In the Humanic line of cases, there's a tension between the case law that says If it's an affirmative defense that negatives any of the facts of the crime, then it's a problem. I'm switching you over to the other issue.
Yes, sir.
But it also has the line of cases that says, that focus, same cases say, also use language saying, the issue is whether or not you free the prosecution, sorry.
Do you get the question?
I do, Your Honor.
Please respond with echoes. You have to respond in kind. The other language in those cases
deals with whether you freed the prosecution of the burden of proving an element. And it seems to be, it depends which thing you focus on as to whether you win the case.
Yes, sir. I think Humanic sets out a stratum of situations in which the affirmed defense bears on the element. On one side, it has where the exactly the same, and that talks about some of the New York case law, some of those cases. The diminished capacity statutes were exactly the same as the affirmative defense and the element. And then on the other side, we have the Martin Patterson line of cases. And under Martin Patterson, Hugh Nicholas Baer says, those are constitutional as long as the jury is instructed that evidence may be used to negate the element of the crime. It noted that the ultimate issues there are posed by one of the elements of the offense and by an affirmative defense are different, but nevertheless are such that the subsidiary facts are relevant to both issues. And then somewhere in the middle lies what we believe this case is, and that is whether the defense is defined in terms of the facts so central to the nature of the offense that, in effect, the prosecution has been freed of the burden. An appellant argues that that's exactly what happened in this case.
How do you respond to the government's argument that, how do you respond to the argument the government makes that force goes to what the accused did and consent is about what the victim did?
Your Honor,
it's central to the case, but the government still required to prove what the accused did.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think force cannot be divorced from lack of consent in this statute, the way it's defined. It's defined as action to compel submission of another to overcome or prevent another's resistance by physical violence, strength in this case. Reading that, the plain language, it's defined by reference to lack of consent, compel submission, overcome resistance, prevent resistance. If force equals compulsion to submit and consent equals submission without compulsion, then the defense is burdened by proving consent to disprove an element of the government's case, which is force, through the implied element of lack of consent.
How does this case differ from Martin v. Ohio?
Martin v. Ohio found that, in the quote, he said that we are thus not moved by assertions that the elements of the aggravated murder and self-defense overlap in the sense that evidence to prove the latter will often tend to negate the former. Maybe
that is what you're saying here?
No, Your Honor. I think it's under the Humex stratification, it's more centrally aligned to something that is so rooted, so central to the nature of the offense that, in effect, the prosecution has been freed of that burden. Martin v. Ohio potentially could think of a theory that, in which case, that self-defense and the elements could be met. What we're arguing today is that force cannot coexist with consent in this statute. Because of the fact, and because of that fact, it's improper for the defense to be forced to prove consent, which necessarily disproves the implied element of lack of consent.
What if Congress had just removed lack of consent as an element and not provided an affirmative defense at all?
I think that would be a valid statute. That is the federal
statute. So, in other words, Congress, in attempting to help the accused, messed it up.
I don't know if they were trying to help the accused. They certainly layered this beyond what was required because of the fact that they forced the defense to actually disprove an element they forced the defense to actually have an affirmative defense, a preponderance of the evidence.
Well, but isn't it Hornbook law from the 17th century on that the burden of proving an affirmative defense lies with he who asserts it?
Yes, Your Honor. However, not with regard to rape or aggravated sexual assault. That has never been the case. Consent has always been an element of that offense.
Well, and Congress chose to remove it as an element, and you say that's fine.
Under case law, yes. I mean, the federal statute is similar to that. Removing it is one thing. Not being able to use consent in order to disprove that, to the element, of course, would
well,
be
what if, I ask my question again, then. What if Congress simply removed consent as an element and provided no affirmative defense?
That would not be a problem because force, as it's always argued, consent would negate that. I mean, that's what the Martin case, the United States versus Martin.
Consent would negate it even in the absence of a specific affirmative defense.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. And that's what Martin Rivera and a Norkay case out of the Eighth Circuit state is that that would necessarily negate the force element.
So what Congress did was surplusage?
Beyond surplusage, it actually put a burden on the defense. It made them, they put a...
You're saying it would have been available anyway.
To actually negate the defense. I mean, the defense has no burden at that point to just knock holes at the government's case. Here, we have the defense actually has a burden in order to...
Well, but the defense can always put on evidence that she consented simply to negate the government's proof of force.
Well, appellant disputes that. Based upon Article 120, subsection R, it seems to indicate that, if I can read it, consent is not an issue or an affirmative defense in a prosecution under any other subsection, except it is an affirmative defense for the sexual conduct in issue in prosecution under subsection E. Article 120R says this consent evidence is not to be used and is anything but an affirmative defense.
Counsel, aren't we a little premature in that? And that is, we don't have instructions from the judge in this case. And how do we know that judge would not instruct that with respect to the issue of force, that can evidence as to consent can be considered by the members as to whether it negatives that and raises a reasonable doubt?
He certainly could have done that, but...
Okay, if that's permissible, and if that's permissible under the statute that you posited before that would be constitutional without an affirmative defense, why is it necessary for the judge to give an affirmative defense instruction if that instruction is objectionable to the defense?
Your Honor, I don't believe it's permissible. I think, by definition, under 120R, the military judge would be constrained to giving an instruction that's based upon 120R. And in that, he would say that it is not an issue. It's only to be considered as an affirmative defense in these four areas.
So you're arguing, in effect, that the judge can't give an instruction to make the statute constitutional, that the defense wants the statute to be read in a manner adverse to the defense so that it will be read as unconstitutional.
Your Honor, it's we would love for a good statute to be there, it would be, but the fact is we have what we have. Mm-hmm. And 120R seems to be unconstitutional per Martin v. Ohio, which specifically says it would be quite different if the jury had been instructed that self-defense evidence could not be considered in determining whether there was a... I see that. I'm a minute over.
That's okay. And I also think that we had judges who had questions on other aspects of the statute, so we'll continue.
With respect to the last point that the Chief Judge asked you about, my understanding wasn't that you wanted it to be read in a particular way, but that you thought that that was the only plausible way that it could be read.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
And if that is the only, if we agree with you that that's the only plausible way that it can be read, do we have the authority to read it otherwise?
No, Your Honor. No, Your Honor. You would have to read it the way that the statute writes, the way that the Congress had wanted it. To finish up on what Martin did state, so it could not be considered to determine whether there was a reasonable doubt about the state's case, i.e. that self-defense must be put aside for all purposes unless it satisfied the preponderance standard. Such instruction would relieve the state of its burden and plainly run afoul of Winship's mandate. Thus, we, whether or not how you define action to compel submission doesn't matter with regard to that last point, because the military judge would have had to give an instruction that prevented the defense or defended, or, sorry, excuse me, that prevented the use of that consent evidence in disproving some of the elements.
Prevent. What would the instruction be?
The instruction would be just as read. Consent is not an issue or an affirmative defense in a prosecution under any other subsection, except it is an affirmative defense for the sexual conduct in an issue in prosecution under subsection A, under this, in this case.
And then you read the statute to prevent the judge from giving a further instruction that consent can also be considered on the issue of reasonable doubt as to force. For example, the type of instruction that Justice Powell suggested in his dissent in the Martin case. Your view is that that instruction, which was not at issue between the majority and the minority in Martin, your view is that that instruction is precluded in this case by 120R.
That's
correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Therefore, we request this Court reverse the lower court's decision and dismiss the case on jurisdictional grounds, or in the alternative, appellant requests this Court affirm the decision of the trial judge. Unless there are further questions.
Thank you, counsel. You have an opportunity on rebuttal.
Good morning, Chief Judge. May it please the Court. The lower court incorrectly found that the affirmative defense was raised in this case. Appellant does deny the objective acts of the offense charged and therefore is simply defending on the elements with no burden of any kind. If this court does agree with the lower court that the affirmative defense was raised in this case, then the statute constitutionally allocates a burden to appellant to prove that affirmative defense.
Counsel, why does the judge have to give an instruction on affirmative defense if the accused doesn't want it and the government doesn't want it? Why does the instruction have to be given if to do so would make the statute unconstitutional?
We are, especially in this case, the military judge does not have to give an instruction on the affirmative defense. The affirmative defense in this case is not properly raised.
Let's assume it was raised. Let's assume that there's enough evidence in there that the person who's alleged to be the victim raised the issue of consent in this case, and the defense raised the issue of consent by their testimony. Why does the judge have to give that instruction if neither party wants it on affirmative defense?
We are under the case law under, I believe, United States versus...
What does case law have to do with interpreting a statute as to whether it's constitutional or not? If to interpret the statute in a manner that would be unconstitutional would require us to apply case law, wouldn't we then modify our case law or say there's an exemption from that past case law to interpret the statute so that it would be interpreted in a constitutional manner? I'm not suggesting that that addresses the other problems that were raised by the defense, but simply in terms of whether placing an affirmative defense at issue makes the statute unconstitutional. I'm not aware of anything in the Constitution or in the Uniform Code of Military Justice that requires the judge to give an affirmative defense instruction that's not wanted by either party.
Government agrees, Your Honor, that anything that that the military judge, you know, any decision made that makes this a constitutional rendering of the statute, obviously, is what we're in favor of.
So basically eviscerating everything that's in the statute that we think is problematic by just suggesting to military judges that they can ignore the parts of the statute that they don't like because they think that it's going to make the statute problematic. We should stretch that far to save the statute?
No, Your Honor. The government is just asking this court to interpret the statute in a constitutional manner. In some areas, for example, Article 120R, there are two possible interpretations of that, part of the statute. And the Supreme Court has stated that courts must, if there are two reasonable interpretations, choose the one that allows it to be constitutional.
Well, here we have a statute that says consent is not an issue. Isn't the government saying to us consent is an issue?
Your Honor, consent is an issue in that evidence raised that could point towards the affirmative defense is also validly applied to the determination of whether or not the government has met its burden beyond reasonable doubt.
What case stands for the proposition that the phrase at issue is equated with an element? You're asking our court to read the statute to say that consent or lack of consent is not an element. But the statute says consent is not an issue. typically, for example, when we're dealing with relevance matters, we talk about something being an issue when it's raised by any evidence. So why is it necessary for us to find that consent or lack of consent as an element in this case when the Congress spoke about consent being an issue rather than an element?
Yes, Your Honor, although if you look in Article 120T15, you see that where Congress wanted to make something clearly irrelevant, it did so when it said that any evidence of the accused's intoxication is not relevant in addressing the mistake of fact defense. So in that case, Congress showed that they did know how to make something irrelevant, and the government's position is that the language consent is not an issue is not the same, is not making it irrelevant, but is simply highlighting the fact that consent or lack of consent was removed as an element in that the government must prove.
The government at trial said that consent not only was at issue in this case, but it was an element. Lack of consent was an element. That's what they said. They repeatedly said they asserted that the statute was unconstitutional, and the judge made his ruling after hearing that from the government. What position does that put us in today when the government's taking a different position here on appeal?
Your Honor, this court reviews the statute and its constitutionality de novo. So the argument of the trial counsel at trial doesn't play any, any part in your determination of whether or not the statute passes muster.
Could you identify for us the concessions that were made by trial counsel with which you agree and the ones with which you don't agree?
Your Honor, we agree with the trial counsel that the affirmative defense was not raised in this case. We do not agree with the trial counsel that lack of consent is an implied element, nor that that the statute is unconstitutional for requiring the accused to disprove an element.
Could you give me a scenario, because you raise it in your brief, can you explain a scenario where the government alleges that the sexual contact occurred by force, and there is evidence that there was consent, and nonetheless they approved their case? I mean, a situation where with evidence of consent, if there's still force.
With evidence of, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I apologize.
If there's evidence of consent, can you explain a scenario where the government can approve beyond a reasonable doubt that the act was committed by force?
Your Honor, the definition.
Since you seem to say that they can't, that they don't coexist, that they're not tied together.
Yes, Your Honor, and if you look at the definition of force in the statute, where it says action to compel submission or prevent resistance, and specifically through three certain types of physical action, physical strength such that she could not escape. For example, some sort of, I suppose, a bondage or other scenario like that, where clearly the accused has taken action that would prevent resistance. Now, the accused may at trial bring in some sort of evidence, either however it's presented, to show that the alleged victim in that case consented to exactly that scenario. In that
but
case,
how can you compel if you consent?
Right.
The problem is with compel, not with the facts. You can come up with some weird facts, I'm sure, but if you've consented to something, how can the other person be compelling you, regardless of how weird and forceful it is?
You're under the definition of force is not compelled submission. There are statutes that phrase it that way, but this one is action to compel submission. Therefore, the focus is on what the accused did as far as what his actions were. If by restraining the other party, whether with their consent or not, you take action that would compel submission or that would prevent them from resisting, whether they intend to resist or not.
Or you consent to that action. Do you agree that if you consent to that action, that would negate force?
No, Your Honor, not under the definition in the statute.
If they consent, why do they have to be compelled?
If they consent, then the action can still be of the type that would compel submission or that can prevent resistance, even if the consenting other party doesn't intend to.
So if the other party initiated it and said, please do this, In the government's perspective, that would still constitute force.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, for example, if the parties agreed to some strange sexual behavior, and they had agreed to it, but it was, quote, unquote, by force, by your definition, that could still be the criminal offense of rape? How does that make any sense?
Your Honor, it would be the criminal defense as far as it would meet the elements that the government must prove. However, the accused would have the opportunity through the affirmative defense.
But isn't that proving exactly what they're saying, which is that they now have the burden to disprove that it was by force?
Your Honor, they're not disproving that it was by force. They have the burden to show that although done by force, that it was through the consent of the victim.
Counsel, I'm not sure I follow the grammatical structure of your argument. The first part of your argument is that the statute, because it uses the phrase to compel rather than the past tense compelled, as I understand it, you're arguing that there's no requirement to prove anything with respect to consent in order for the government to prevail. That is, if the government shows that a certain degree of force was used, then the government prevails following all the incorporated definitions. So then my question is, what if there's evidence of consent and it's not going to be used as an affirmative defense, what specific aspect of the elements of the case is negatived by the use of the evidence of consent, whether it's presented by the defense or presented by the government? Defense counsel is going to make an argument now, and defense counsel at trial wants to point to something about consent to show that that it negatives an element. Which element is being negative by that evidence of consent? What does it show be? What does it raise a reasonable doubt as to?
Your Honor, the element that it would most likely impact upon or tend to negate would be force.
And why is that?
Because any, I guess, subsidiary or any evidence towards consent would usually not negate whether or not any sexual contact occurred. I mean, for example, I guess an example would be where both parties acknowledge that the contact occurred, and the defense brings in witnesses to talk about either, you know, the behavior of the two people before the alleged incident or the behavior of the victim afterwards, and they're trying to raise the affirmative defense of consent. Now, the members could either decide that whatever happened happened with force, but it happened by her consent based on this evidence, or failing that, they could determine that it probably, if it happened, didn't happen by force because of this consent evidence. So that would...
Sorry, how do you deal with the last sentence? If the defense has met the burden, if the defense proves something by a preponderance of the evidence, isn't that a reasonable doubt?
Your Honor, certainly if the defense has proven their burden or has met their burden, then the accused should be acquitted.
How do you deal with the last sentence then of the affirmative defense?
The government believes it to be a legal nullity, sir, an impossibility, that that after the defense has met its burden and proved beyond a reasonable or by a preponderance of the evidence that the victim consented, that there's no possible way that the government can come back with another bite of
that. So that piece of the paragraph is unconstitutional if applied that way?
I guess it's just impossible, Your Honor. It's not possible for, once the burden has been met and they've proved something by preponderance of the evidence, for the government then
to disprove. So how should military judges handle that in instructions, in your view?
Your Honor, the military judge should instruct that the accused has the burden to prove by preponderance of the evidence, and that if they find that he's met that burden, that he should be acquitted.
As I understand your position, the defense was not raised here because he didn't admit force.
No, Your Honor, because denied.
Your brief seems to say that in order to assert an affirmative defense, one must first admit every element of the offense and then assert the affirmative defense. Isn't that what you said in your brief?
No, Your Honor, we said that they cannot deny, and that's based on the definition both in RCM 916 and in Article 120, that the accused cannot deny if he does not deny the objective acts of the offense charged. In this case, he doesn't have to take the stand, he doesn't have to present any evidence at all, admitting or denying. In this case, he did. He took the stand and he denied the element of force as presented by the government, the objective acts charged.
Okay, how was it not raised?
It's not raised, Your Honor, because although it's termed as consent evidence because that's what they're talking about, her behavior and her actions, that really what he is saying is is I didn't use force. It's not consent evidence that raises the affirmative defense. It's non-force evidence that just serves to defend with no burden, as you would in any case, any regular assault case, perhaps, where you dispute whether or not you actually used force against the alleged.
Okay, so it wasn't raised because he didn't introduce any evidence of consent. It's not that he has to admit everything and then assert the affirmative defense.
No, Your Honor, he just can't deny it, as he does here.
Can I ask you a question on the jurisdictional issue? What is your position first as to whether as to the impact of double jeopardy on later efforts to re-prosecute? Let's say that we agree with everything that you say. First of all, what's your position as to whether or not double jeopardy would preclude further prosecution of the same appellant?
Well, Your Honor, it would appear that if this case goes back, that potentially they'll have to determine whether or not a mistrial is appropriate or how to handle the case, this case that we're currently in. And then if the case does go to a second trial, if the mistrial is properly declared, then the government believes there's a way for the government to go forward and prosecute the appellant again.
Okay, and so that's my second question, which is procedurally, precisely, how do you think that the government would be able to go about re-prosecuting this person with another court-martial? Do you think it would have to be referred to a new court-martial, or what do you think would have to happen?
Yes, sir. I believe that most likely this would have to come back, be reconvened. The military judge would have to make determination on mistrial or not based on the intervening events.
And when you say intervening events, you mean the court-martial members meeting with the counsel and talking with them?
Yes, sir.
I'm confused about something you said. You said with the last sentence of paragraph 16 that if the appellant, if the accused proves consent by preponderance of the evidence, he should get an acquittal.
Yes,
you
yes,
said that. But earlier you said that consent does not negate action to compel submission. So why should you necessarily get an acquittal if you prove consent by a preponderance of the evidence?
Well, Your Honor, that's what the statute lays out, is that if, I guess in a standard affirmative defense scenario, if the accused were not to deny the events that he is charged with, but instead raised as his affirmative defense that the alleged victim consented to those events, to those objective acts, then separate from a determination as to whether or not the government had met its burden on the elements beyond a reasonable doubt, the members could then take up, as to the affirmative defense, whether or not he has proven by a preponderance of the evidence that although the acts occurred, that there is this legal excuse, this affirmative defense.
Counsel, we finished, Judge Baker? I may have heard two different answers to different questions, so I want to make sure. In response to Judge Baker's question, it appears that you said that the issue of consent would not negative the action taken by the accused. But in response to my questions, you said that consent could be used to negative force. So the question is, if there's evidence of consent, putting aside the whole issue of affirmative defense, we're talking about consent in terms of whether it raises a reasonable doubt on the government's burden. Does the consent negative the objective description of the actions taken by the accused, or does it negative the accused intent to commit those actions? That is consent here something that shows that the accused did not take action to compel, which it would seem not to, according to your definition, because your definition is one in which the action is observed objectively from what the accused did rather than from what the alleged victim responded. So if it doesn't negative that, does it then negative the intent? And that is, the accused's defense at that point is, my evidence as to consent, or the government's evidence as to consent, whatever evidence it is, shows that the accused did not act with an intent to commit this crime when he, which let's use he in the case like this, applied that degree of force.
I guess neither, Your Honor. The consent, I guess evidence that we're terming is consent, if it's being used.
Real simple. Somebody introduces evidence that they heard her say yes. Okay, and that's factually disputed, but there's evidence there. And the defense counsel wants to rely on it. What does the judge instruct the members that that word yes is used to negative? Does it negative the degree of force? Does it negative intent? Does it negative something else? What is it at issue for?
Your Honor, it's an issue as to whether or not the force occurred in the first place, as to whether or not if the accused version of events is that she said yes and therefore he did not restrain her, he did not use physical strength or any of the other types of actions described under the force definition, then that evidence is used simply to defend under the element of force.
Counsel, that's contrary to your argument on what the element of force is about, because you said the element of force depends solely on what the actor did. And in the case that we're talking about, the actor did all those things. The actor applied that degree of force. And the word yes is being debated in that case for something else, not to negative whether he did that, but is it to negative his intent, or as the statute suggests in R, it can't be used at all. What is it being used for if the defense is allowed to raise it?
Your Honor, I apologize, I've misunderstood the scenario. But yeah. If the accused is, I guess, not...
Your time is going to wrap, but you can answer this question and other questions the judges might have.
If the accused is not denying the force element that the government is charging, but introduces evidence of the victim's consent, then that goes to the affirmative defense, Your Honor. It should not implicate either the degree of force or whether or not the action was being taken.
A case is not necessarily going to be that clean. You're going to have evidence as to the degree of force, and the accused may deny that degree of force and might also argue if members find that there's that degree of force, then her saying yes negatives something else. What is it that it negatives? Are you saying here that the defense can only use consent if they have evidence of consent if the accused admits that the degree of force was used? Otherwise, the accused can't use consent to negative any other element here?
No, Your Honor. The accused can use the evidence of her consent either as an affirmative defense if he doesn't deny the force in the things that the government charges. But he can also, if he doesn't meet his burden there, that evidence can still
be used. This is a prosecution. He doesn't have to deny or admit anything. The government has introduced proof of an act. And the government's proof, the government argues the proof shows a degree of force to meet the statute. There's also evidence in the case that the putative victim said yes. The defense doesn't have to prove anything there in a normal criminal case. Are you saying that the defense now has to get up and say something about whether they agree or disagree with the amount of force that was used and whether it's proved or not before they can talk about consent?
No.
Okay. So how does the accused talk about consent when the accused doesn't have to say anything about admitting or denying anything? We're dealing with only prosecution case. The defense hasn't put on anything.
Yes, Your Honor, then you would be using it to show, the defense counsel would argue that the evidence introduced of the victim's consent shows that the accused did not use the force as it's defined in the statute, either because the degree was not sufficient to meet the definition of force in the statute or because he didn't use any at all.
Because she consented. And that goes back to the Chief Judge's question before, which is how does that square with the way that you define force? The way that you interpret the way force is defined in the statute, which is it focuses solely on what the accused did.
That's right, because she consented, not necessarily to the force, but because she consented, he didn't have to use force. He didn't have to use the degree of force that is required for the to prove the element that the government has to prove.
How much force is force?
As defined in the statute, Your Honor, it's physical violence, strength, power, restraint, sufficient that the other person could not avoid or escape the sexual contact.
If the court were to decide as a matter of argument that consent fully negates force, do you lose, or do you have an alternative argument in that case?
If consent fully negates force, Your Honor, the the Supreme Court has stated that putting an affirmative defense with a burden on the accused is constitutional, as long as the accused does not, I guess, assume a burden that the government is required to otherwise show. So if the government still holds the burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the force that's necessary to convict, then the statute should still be constitutional.
If there are two sides of the same coin, you lose. If there are not two sides of the same coin, you win.
Well, Your Honor, under Martin v. Ohio, certainly it talks about overlapping versus being two sides of the same coin. So, certainly in this case, the definitions show that they are not two sides of the same coin. They are, they're focused on separate people and separate actors and their actions.
Counsel, you may briefly sum up.
Your Honor, the lower court incorrectly found that the affirmative defense was raised in this case. However, if this court determines that they were correct, then government asks this court to affirm their finding that the statute was constitutional and to send this back to the trial.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have a rebuttal?
Because lack of consent is necessary to prove force, and because the defense is burdened with proving consent, the defense is thus burdened with disproving force, an element of the government's case.
Well, is lack of consent necessary to prove force? You don't have to prove lack of consent, you just prove force.
Yes, Your Honor. It's an implied element, though, as defined within the statute.
Well, wait a minute. Congress explicitly dropped it.
It did.
You're saying that Congress's action was nugatory?
Congress's action, yeah. With how they define force, yes, it is, because they define force with reference to consent. So, yes, we're disproving force. And why are we disproving force? Because of the fact that we have to prove consent.
Let me ask you this in response to that last bit. Let's say this court were to find that consent negates the element of force. The government then argued that it's nonetheless constitutional because the government's not relieved of the burden to prove force.
Yes,
in other words, it's still not relieved of the burden to prove what the accused did rather than what the victim did. What's your response to that?
Your Honor, I think the Humanik and Martin and Patterson cases are the cases that we have to look at. Martin v. Ohio has a case that's very similar in the Fourth Circuit. It's called Smart v. Leak. And in that case, they found it was basically the same analysis of self-defense and aggravated murder. And they found that self-defense in the South Carolina law, in Smart v. Leak, because of the fact that it did negative it, was unconstitutional. That's different from Martin v. Ohio. Because Martin v. Ohio said that the definition weren't necessarily correlated. They weren't two sides of the same coin. That's what we're arguing in this case. However, I think even if it weren't the exact same opposite, if force did not could not exist with consent, even in a situation where you could think of a plausible or not a plausible, but a situation, as strange as it might be, I think this is still unconstitutional, and Humanik v. Bear sets out that secondary ground. There is a stratification of what's allowed in these cases.
Counsel, how strange is the situation in which the government introduces a degree of force and the dispute among the parties is as to the degree of force? Is either party required to say anything about consent in that case? Is the government required to prove that it was without consent?
In essence, yes, because it's required to prove that it's not just this act of force, but it's act to compel submission. So it's not just an act, and you can't divorce the act from the fact that it has to compel submission.
So the government loses if it just introduces witnesses who see the degree of force?
Yes, Ron.
In the federal statute, which also does not have consent as an element, is the government required to prove lack of consent?
No, Your Honor, they're not. However, the case law has stated that consent will negate the causation. The Martin, the Rivera, and the U.S. v. Norgay, which is an Eighth Circuit case that's cited in one of those cases.
But in the federal statute, it appears that consent is not even an implied element.
Not within the statute, but the way the case law has outlined it or has defined it, yes. It says that consent will negate the causation element of it.
Well, is that the same thing? I mean, it's one thing to say that they don't have to prove, it's, Congress dropped it as an element, right, explicitly. It may negate it, but that doesn't mean the government has to prove it. The government does not have to prove lack of consent. You're just saying that the government really has to prove lack of consent.
They have to prove force.
They have to prove force.
It's a different scenario than ours because we actually have an affirmative duty under our statute in order to prove consent.
So is the problem then with the creation of the affirmative defense, or is the problem with the definition of rape or the sexual acts in the statute? Which is the problem?
I think a combination of them, and I think probably separately as well. If they removed consent totally, as the federal circuit or the federal case statute has done, obviously we have precedent for that. And the application, we would just apply it the way that the federal courts would do. This affirmative defense, the only other jurisdiction that has this is Washington, D.C. And even they have outlined that you can't have the Martin limitation where you can only use the evidence for the affirmative defense and not the actual not be able to prove, disprove part of the government's case.
What is the constitutional principle you seek to uphold today?
I think there are two due process concerns. It's In re Winship and the Davis principle.
Just cited in plain English, what is the constitutional principle?
The government has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt all the elements of the government's case. And the defense is never burdened with disproving an element of the government's case.
The burden of proof is the constitutional issue that's at stake today.
That's correct.
I don't want to...
Yes, it is.
And which of the Article III cases that you've cited stand for the proposition that the judge has to give a reasonable doubt instruction with respect to the implied element of consent?
Has to have a reasonable doubt instruction?
Right. In other words, if it's an element, you got to instruct on it.
There is none.
There is none. There's no case on that.
No, Your Honor.
And which case stands for the proposition in the Article III system that an affirmative defense does not have to be instructed on?
I have no case law on that, Your Honor.
And which case in the military justice system stands for the proposition that an affirmative defense instruction has to be given as a matter of either the Uniform Code of Military Justice or constitutional law?
I am not aware of any, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Are there no further questions?
Thank you, counsel, and we thank both counsel for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will stand in recess until 9:30 a.m. tomorrow morning.
All rise.